Hello everyone and welcome to episode 2 of the Skype show. Today I've got Corey with me and we've got Matt Landis, who's their well-known MVP. Matt's going to be talking a little bit later on about Attendant Pro and his Cepha Util server edition. So the first session is going to be about Skype for Business certificates and all the implications around that. Session 2 will be Matt's session. And then session 3, we'll be talking about the mobile app and how to deploy it. Session 4, as always, will be Q&A. If you use our Yammer feed to ask us questions or look us up on Twitter using at Unified Vale or at Corey_MCSE or at Matthew Landis, we'll be happy to take your questions at the end of the show. So without further ado, we've got a lot on tonight, so we'll crack on with session 1.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you're joining us from. So again, as Mark said, thank you for taking the time to join us on the second episode of the Skype show. We hope you enjoyed the first episode. We've been getting some really good feedback from that from the community. So yep, it's definitely motivated us to keep the show up, and hopefully you like the sound of this topic that we've got ready for you today. So what I'll be talking to you today is about everyone's favourite topic that nobody likes to talk about, and that is certificates. In many, many deployments, during a deployment phases, during the operational phases, certificates can really be the bane of our life, and they're often looked at as the more complex side of a Link deployment, Skype for Business deployment. But in reality, if you actually understand the certificates process, if you actually plan your certificates accordingly, then they're really nothing to be afraid of in any way, shape or form. The common question that we always get from clients and users around the Link side of things is, do we actually need certificates? The short answer is yes. Can we avoid them? The shorter answer is no. So in summary, certificates are used for a lot of scenarios and a lot of traffic flow. So in particular, client-to-server authentication, so TLS, HTTP web traffic connections, client authentication, TLS, DSK, they all use the certificate process. Server-to-server communications, so we use the MTLS protocol in that kind of traffic flow. Now, if we are using the newer versions of Exchange, SharePoint, and Link as well, then open authentication is something that those servers will use between each other, and that's another dependency upon certificates. Now, there's two types of certificates that we can use. Firstly, we can use public certificates, and they are from a public trusted authority. So basically, the likes of GoDaddy, Komodo, and so on. Or we can use internal certificates. Now, there are specific server roles that depend upon, that actually mandate the type of certificate that you require. So our internal servers, so our directors, our front end pools, standalone mediation server pools, if we have any deployed, persistent chat, and SBAs, they can all use internal certificate authorities. So if you have an internal PKI deployed, then we can most definitely use that infrastructure. And also included in that list as well is the internal interface of the Edge server. Now, if you don't have an internal PKI available to you, then you can actually use a public authority across the full estate. Obviously, there are cost implications around that because the internal servers typically require a significant amount of SANs depending upon how many SIP domains that you've got deployed. So there's additional consideration that needs to be taken there. But in effect, if you are going to use a mixture of internal and external public certificate authorities, then the external authority must be used for your Edge external interface as well as your reverse proxy external interfaces as well. And for a list of the approved certificate authorities to use within Link and Skype for Business, then you can simply search that in Bing or with your favorite search provider, and they'll send you over a list. You'll find a list of approved providers. Now, across all of our certificates, we do have some common requirements, and I won't refer to all of them there because you can read the points on the slides, but I do want to call a few out. And One of the ones that's always asked, and I mean, I've come across several deployments where I've looked at the, say, the key usages on the certificates, and I can see that the certificates have not only been enabled for server authentication, but also client authentication as well. And I think that purely comes down to just a misunderstanding of what the certificates are doing. So the certificate with a common name of a certificate server FQDN is authenticating that server. It is not authenticating a client, although the client is using it to authenticate the process. So it is, I can kind of see the where the logic comes from, but it is an incorrect approach to take. And all the servers basically must support the server authentication EKU. Now, the second point on there is definitely a hot topic that we've seen in the community, and that is your CRL distribution points. CRL stands for your certificate revocation list, and it's basically a list of all the servers that the given certificate authority has revoked, so maybe no longer valid or maybe compromised for whatever reason, but the certificate is no longer valid for use. Now, if a server can't contact a CRL distribution point, then we basically see that certificate as untrusted and do not trust that certificate. Now, if you Bing or Google search the CRL distribution points and Edge server, you'll find very interesting topics around that, where several workarounds have been recommended. So we can use things like Internet Explorer to disable the checks for CRL distribution points. But as I've bolded on my slide there, please do avoid workarounds. It's important that we keep in mind that we are talking about security. So wherever, I mean, it's if you spoke to security admins about disabling checks for CRLs, I'm sure that a lot of the hairs would raise on the back of their necks. So it's not the best approach to take. And we would recommend that if your certificate authorities don't contain CRL distribution points at the moment, then let's not build on a weaker foundation. Let's actually address the issue. Let's address the PKI. Let's configure it correctly, and then start building on our Skype for Business topology from there. The operating system that you're using to actually sign the certificate must support the signing algorithm that you're requesting, which is a given. Now, if you've taken advice around things like Windows Fabric, etc., then you will be using Windows Server 2012 R2 for all of your server roles, which will give you some of the more stronger signing algorithms for your certificates. RSA is the default signing algorithm, but again, I'm not even going to attempt to read out the acronyms that are on the screen, but I'm sure you can see that there are other default signing algorithms that we do support. And then to increase the security around those signing algorithms, we can increase the key length. So 1024 is available. We recommend that we go over 248 key length or higher. So that'll be 248 or 4096 key length. And then finally, auto enrollment on your internal servers as well. So it's unsupported, obviously, for Edge servers being non-domain joined servers. And then, yeah, if you are still running Windows Server 2003, then firstly, tell yourself off. And then secondly, web-based requests as listed on the page must be submitted from a computer that's actually running a similar operating system. But hopefully you're not running Windows XP and Server 2003 in your estate. For the request process is, I'm sure, sort of familiar process to everyone. So we've got, there's actually three ways of requesting the certificates. Now, if we don't have the servers built, then therefore we won't have the management shell or deployment wizard available to us. So we can simply use the certificate store MMC snap-in to request our certificates in advance. And that, again, it's actually a good practice to take into account, because it just means that you're thinking about certificates ahead of the deployment and you're planning them accordingly. So it gives you time to vet them and ensure that you've got the correct subject names and the correct subject alternative names. So however you create your certificate, whether it be the MMC, Management Shadow or Deployment Wizard, what the request process actually is doing is when you create that certificate request, you're actually generating a public and a private key. And that is actually tied down to that certificate. Now, the private key is something that is owned by that machine that you are creating the request from. So that's definitely something to keep in mind. And then, of course, you go ahead and populate the information as required. Now, if you're using a deployment wizard, then it actually cleverly does add the required subject names and subject alternative names into your certificates for you. But if you are creating them manually, then yep, you've got the option to populate that information from there. Once we've got all of the information together and compiled in our request, which is obviously the CSR, we then submit that CSR to a certificate authority who will go ahead and verify and create that signed certificate on the CA. Now, I've seen situations where the certificate templates that are available from a CA don't support the web server template, or maybe the web server template has been renamed to something else. But what we're doing with the templates is basically pre-populating a lot of the required attributes that are required from servers. So that's why it is mandatory that we use the web server certificate template. Once we've got the certificate from the CA, we go ahead then and accept that certificate, install it on the local machine. Now, one of the biggest issues that we've seen, especially when troubleshooting, when we're supporting users on the forums, is that a request has been made from machine A, so therefore the private key has been and public key has been generated, but that machine is not the machine that actually requires a certificate. So then when the certificate has been issued, the user actually attempts to install the certificate on machine 2, but because machine 2 doesn't have the original public and private key, we just don't get the associated private key, so we cannot use that certificate for trust. So I will talk a little bit later on that when I come on to the troubleshooting the common issues, but that is definitely one of the common issues for us. I don't want to spend too much time on these slides because, yeah, it's a case of reading more than anything. But from a front-end server perspective, you can see that we require 3 certificates. Now, you'll see that through the pool FQDNs, et cetera, and the requirements across each of the certificates, you'll notice that there's quite a lot of duplication. And that's one of the reasons why we typically see a front-end server that's got a single certificate assigned to all 3 services. And to take that one step further, you might be thinking, well, why do I need a common name and a subject alternative name that point to the same location? And that's purely because things like TLS don't actually check the subject names of your certificates. They only query the subject alternative names. So you will see some duplications across those as well. So the front end server certificates, I mean, we've got a default certificate, a web internal, the web external certificate. You can see that the external web services FQDN is tied down to your external certificate. And if you're using a pool, then we're using the internal web services FQDN on the internal certificate. If this is a standard edition server, then your internal web services FQDN is going to equate to your server FQDN. So that's why there's less of a requirement on there, because you're already covered in the server FQDN. The same applies to the director as well. There's a lot of duplication between the required SANs and common names, and therefore we typically see a single server assigned to all 3 server roles. Mediation and SBA requirements. Now, if you've got a standalone mediation server pool, then common name would equate to the mediation pool FQDN. And again, because of the TLS checks, you'd also need that in the SAN, but then you'd also need an entry for each of the member servers that are in that pool as well. Now, it would be a best practice to assign an individual certificate to each of those servers and to not list too many member server FQDNs that are not required. But that, again, leads to a slightly increased operational overhead. But I think that I really do feel as though that operational overhead is outweighed by just the security factor and the security element that we're discussing. Edge server requirements are definitely an interesting topic when it comes to certificates. So you can see that the internal interface, we simply require a common name referring to the Edge pool FQDN. And then from an external perspective, we typically equate the subject name to the Access Edge FQDN. Now, this, not many people are aware of this, but it's actually no longer a requirement as of Link Server 2013 to name your common name after your Access Edge FQDN. But for backwards compatibility with things like OCS, we do see it as a best practice, and it kind of has become just a given to keep that simplicity and to keep that consistency. So we do typically see the common name equating to the Access Edge FQDN, but then we also require the Access Edge FQDN as a subject alternative name, as well as the WebConf FQDN. If you're going to support automatic client signing, then we need a SIP entry for each SIP domain that you have configured within your topology. Now, you might be questioning yourself as to why there's 3 edge services that we run, being Access Edge, WebConf, and AV. But AV doesn't actually require any certificate requirements, and that's purely because it runs a slightly separate authentication process for actually allocating ports to be able to use audio and video sessions, which we'll touch on to slightly in a second. So yes, AV agents and AV agent certificates. So basically, the AV Edge authentication service uses the external Edge certificate to issue tokens to users. Those tokens are then used to authenticate requests and allocate ports with the media relay authentication service on the Edge server. And that is simply why the AV Edge FQDN isn't required upon our public certificate, because it's a slightly different security mechanism. And one thing that we see when we talk to security admins and firewall admins, network admins, is that when they see the 50k port range being opened up, they often do get quite scared. But if you actually really look at the edge server, you will notice that the ports aren't actively open and listening for connections. They're only spawned as and when a token authentication request has been approved and validated. So less to be concerned about, because edge, we are provisioning edge in a secure manner to securely enable our media traversal. The tokens by default last for 8 hours. That can be configured at your expense. We typically see that being left at the default period, but effectively when a certificate expires, the associated tokens that have been generated using that certificate also expire, and therefore that leads to failed AV media sessions. So one thing that we can do to overcome those failed media sessions, and it's one thing that I don't see many deployments doing, but it's a really cool feature, is actually staging certificates. Now what we can do is, this process is only applicable, as you can see on the slide, to the audio video authentication service and the open auth token issuer. It's not applicable to any other services, although we can use the single certificate and apply the stage certificate to the edge. Well, I'll touch on that at a later date. But basically what it involves is actually the process of procuring the new certificate, installing the new certificate, and then telling either the OAuth service or the AV Edge service to use that certificate at a given period of time. So we can basically account for the token overlap between your sessions, basically, to prevent those failed media sessions. So if you're looking to do this kind of thing, then staging an AV Edge certificate, you will need to request your certificates in a slightly different way. So if you're used to using a deployment wizard for your Edge certificates, then you'll see that only the default service is available. And that's to be expected, that is by design. If you want to decouple your Access Edge FQDN and Web FQDN certificates away from AV Edge, then what you actually need to do is use the management shell to create your certificate request that will actually let you create isolated certificate requests. As it says on the slide, it is possible to stage an entire default certificate, but because the Access Edge FQDN and the web conferencing FQDN don't support the staging, the services don't support the staging process, you still will need to restart those services for them to pick up the new certificate and start to use that new certificate. So it is only supported for the open authentication and the AV Edge service. Here's the actual command that you would use to stage your certificate. So as I said, first things first, we need to actually procure that certificate in a trusted way and install that certificate, making sure that we've got the associated private key as well. But then once we've done that, it's essentially a case of running the setcs certificate command with the type specified as audio video authentication. Specify your certificate thumbprint, the role and effective date of the commands that are actually bringing this staging process into life. So the effective date is effectively the activation date, well, when the date when the certificate will become effective. Now, because of the default token expiry period of 8 hours on a certificate, it's always recommended to allow for that overlap. So what we recommend is that in a real world scenario, you might want to look at the following command. So firstly, let's request and install the certificate into the personal store. Now, based on the assumption that our certificate is set to our external certificate is set to expire on the 3rd of February at 7 p.m. What we actually need to do to make sure that we've got full token overlap is to predefine and activate our new certificate 8 hours before the actual expiry of the other. So in that instance, if our certificate is set to expire on the 3rd of February at 7 p.m, then we want to stage our new certificate to become active on the 3rd of February at 11 o'clock in the morning. You can see the command that we use to run that on there. So allocate the thumbprint, allocate your role and effective date parameters, and then at the predefined period of time, that certificate will then become the active certificate to issue those tokens for media relay authentication requests. You can see that if there is a process, so the new certificate is used to validate the tokens. If a token that a user presents to the AV service has been generated using the older certificate, then of course the validation will fail against the new certificate, but it does fail back and check the previous certificate before failing the AV media session. So in effect, during that 8 hour period of time, we are validated against two certificates, which allow you to transition your AV sessions in a productive way. Once the old certificate has expired and is no longer validating token requests to users, we can use the remove CS certificate command to take that certificate out of action, and then we will repeat the process when the new current certificate is set to expire. And again, I've got another example on the screen for your Open North certificates, but the difference with this is that the fact that the AV Edge authentication service tokens last for 8 hours, whereas to allow for replication to local servers, what we actually recommend is that you have a 24-hour lead time with your CMS certificates, sorry, with your Open Office certificates, and that's to allow enough time for the certificate to be replicated into the topology and then out to the remaining servers as well. So as you're aware, we implement OAuth on one server and then allow Skype for Business Short Link replication to populate the certificate store on the remaining servers. But key thing to remember is that if our certificate is set to expire on, say, the 3rd of February, 7 p.m, then we want the new effective certificate to be in place from the 2nd of February at 7 p.m, just to allow that 24-hour period, which will allow for replication to take place. And there's a slight difference in there being the type of certificate that we expire, so that we specify. So instead of specifying audio video authentication, we're now specifying OAuth token issuer. Touching onto the reverse proxy, so the remaining server, along with the Edge external interface, the reverse proxy external interface is the only other interface that mandates that we use public certificates. So at the moment, if you look at the actual approved list, the Open Interoperability Program, you'll see that only WAP, so Web Application Proxy, and F5 are listed as supported appliances. Now, I'm sure there's a lot of people on the session at the moment that will say, we've used A, we've used B, we've used C. Yes, we're all in the same boat as well. We know that in the real world, there are many, many different products that are supported. So yeah, it's just a case of making sure that they support the actual requirements for a reverse proxy. And then if they do, then you can be confident that they will go ahead and be supported in a link scenario. From a certificate perspective for the reverse proxy, we specify the common name as the External Web Services FQDN. Now, this is also a typical area where a lot of users may go wrong with their deployment. We find that a lot of time customers simply just do not know what their External Web Services FQDN is. And if you are looking for it, then it's just simply a case. I mean, the simplest way of doing it is using PowerShell. But if you're not comfortable with that, then you can simply download your topology using Topology Builder, check your pool properties, and your External Web Services FQDN is listed there. That External Web Services FQDN is a public service, so it requires a public A record, and then therefore the appropriate public certificate as well, because we are going to be taking requests from non-domain servers and external clients, etc. But effectively, in the certificate, one of the areas that you may be looking at the moment is the wildcards for the simple URLs. You can almost guarantee that once a week, the question is asked on the TechNet forums as to whether wildcards are supported or not. And with my Microsoft hat on, the answer is they are only supported when representing the simple URLs in your subject alternative names. In the real world, I have seen scenarios where the wildcard is actually specified as the common subject name, but in best practice, don't avoid that at all means, and just basically secure your certificates in a secure way, and let's not take any shortcuts to get things working properly. So when we're looking at certificates and we're listening to the problems that users are facing, some of the common issues that we see are users have procured certificates, they've installed the certificate, but then when trying to use that certificate and assign it to a service, there's no private key allocated to it. What we recommend is that if you're going to prepare your certificates in advance, is that if you create your request on machine A, then that certificate must be installed on machine A, and that's because machine A that requested the certificate is the only machine that is going to have the appropriate private key to decrypt that certificate. So therefore, if you do use a management machine to create your certificates in advance, then it's a case of installing them back on the management machine, but then exporting them with the private key, which again is not the best thing to do, because where it's not required, you don't want to mark a private key as exportable. Another issue that we've seen with the Edge servers as well is the trusted root certificate chain. So before you try and assign your internal certificate to your Edge internal interface, just make sure that you've got your trusted root chain installed on the server. In the past, I don't believe it's no longer an issue. I've not seen it for a while, but in the past, we have seen issues where if you have a non-self-signed certificate in the trusted root or certification store, then the front-end service RTC server process just simply will not start. And it's a case of what we sometimes see is that there's intermediate or issuing CA certificates in the Trusted Root Store. Let's keep things tidy. Again, let's build on that strong foundation and make sure that in your Trusted Root Store, you only use Trusted Root certificates and Trusted Root authorities. A big one that we always see is the missing CRL distribution points. So if the edge servers and reverse proxy servers can't verify the certificates that they're communicating with, then effectively the services will start to prevent new communications to them. There are countless workarounds around this. So Internet Explorer is the first one that comes to mind and preventing the check for CRLs. Please do not do this. The best thing to do is work on your certificate authority from day one, plan it appropriately. If it doesn't have a CDP location at the moment, then let's specify one, because by default, only LDAP locations are specified. Now, because your edge server is non-domain joined, LDAP is irrelevant to that server, so therefore we must specify a HTTP location for that certificate revocation distribution point. The last one that I want to quickly touch on before I hand over to Matt is the Federation CRL checks. So we can't be responsible for all of the certificates that our federated partners are using. Typically, the public providers are good with their distribution points in that they will always have a HTTP location on there, but it's not always the case. So there's sometimes issues where we just simply can't check for the CRL, and that's typically the case when port 80 isn't allowed outbound from the access edge service. If we can't check for CRLs, then federation can be prevented with federated partners. There is a command on the screen at the moment, and as I've rightfully said, it's for troubleshooting purposes only. So if you are troubleshooting your federation issues, then you might want to put this command in place if you're looking at the issue from a certificate perspective, just to make sure that the CRLs are not causing the issue. Well, please rerun that command with the true variable at the end of it before when you're finished. And another one that we've seen again is disabling users. So by default, there's multiple authentication methods that are available for users, so Kerberos, MTLM, or TLS-DSK, aka certificates. So when a user selects that Save My Password button, an X509 certificate is created in that personal user store. By default, 180-day validity period, which can cause some significant concerns, because if that user leaves the organization, for example, and you disable their Active Directory user account, the actual link client won't perform any AD account checks. It will actually sign in using the certificate that it's been granted to previously. So to correctly remove a user from link server, it's either a case of removing them from link server or actually revoking their client certificate. So you'll see that on the last slide that I've actually got some of the management commands. But effectively, revoke-CS client certificate and the appropriate identity and switches will effectively remove that certificate from that user and prevent it from acting as an authentication method. But as it says on the page, disabling AD account will not prevent access at all. There is still certificate-based authentication. If you're looking to troubleshoot certificates, then I mean, there's a few simple checks that you can make. One of my favorite tools is the CertUtil tool that will help you check your key usages, any certificate attributes that might be missing, any certificate template issues, as well as the full chain, any missing chain certificate records, etc. But as a few simple checks, I mean, what I would typically do is run through the list that I've got populated on the screen at the moment. So just making sure that you're using the correct subject names and subject alternative names. Has the certificate expired? Is it still operating within a valid time period? Do you have the complete certificate chain installed on the local machine, in particular edge servers as well, because they won't pull them down automatically? Have we got the right EKU, so it has key usage? So have we got the server authentication key usage on there? And also, just as we briefly touched on there, the CRL distribution points as well, and just making sure that if you've not got them in your CA before you deploy Link, let's just update the CA, because obviously if we issue the certificates and then include a CRL distribution point, it's only new certificates that are issued that will actually pick up on that. Again, just to touch upon there, so on the screen now you can see some of the management commandlets that we actually use to manage certificates. The one at the very bottom there, revoke-CS client certificate, that's the command that you'd run if you wanted to prevent a user from signing in following on from a disabled AD account, so just to prevent that user from using client certificates as their authentication method. I won't spend too much time on that slide because yeah, you could. They're all available on TechNet, which you'll be able to get a much more detailed description on what they actually do. So again, thank you for joining me during episode 2. I hope that you've taken some content from that. I'm now going to hand over to Matt Landis, who will put on a good show. Thank you for that.
Hey. Glad to be able to talk to the Skype for Business community. And what I would like to do for just a couple minutes, we're not going to spend a long time, we're not going to try to drag this out, but just for a couple minutes, take a look at some of the things that we have been doing behind the scenes. Some of these are commercial efforts and some are community efforts. And a couple of those are something that we've been developing for a little while and selling commercially, and that is Attendant Pro, an attendant console. Also, Call Recording Pro, which is a new call recording solution that we're coming out with very shortly. And then also Cepha Util Server, which is a replacement for Microsoft's a free PowerShell replacement for Microsoft Cepha Util. So just get our next slide here. All right. So a couple things about the products that we've been putting out there. Landis Technologies now has customers in about 27 countries, and that's with a couple products that we have. We also have customers, a lot of customers in many sectors all around the world. And what we are trying to do with our products is integrate the existing Microsoft technologies for a seamless communication experience, whether that's in our recording solution, our attendant console solution, and now our Cepha Util server product. We're bringing together tools like Skype for Business, Exchange, OneDrive, Windows Server, and Azure to make a really seamless communication experience in our products, whether they are a client product or server product. So Attendant Pro is really, it's been out now for over a year. Like we said, I said 27 countries. I think today and yesterday we sold into Greenland and Serbia, which makes it about 28. But we really, Attendant Pro is an operator attendant console that really is simple to implement. And it looks and works just like Skype for Business. So our goal with Attendant Pro, we're adding features all the time, but really what our goal is for Attendant Pro is to be the go-to client-based attendant console for Skype for Business and Office 365. So I won't spend a lot of time on it. A lot of you are probably familiar with it, but if not, go to landiscomputer.com/attendantpro and make sure you have an attendant console for your enterprise voice implementations and cloud PBX. All right. And then another thing that is new that we are just coming out with, and that is Call Recording Pro. It's going to be out within the month. And it's really, once again, a client-based call recording solution for Skype for Business Server and Office 365 Cloud PBX. It's really, you install a 1 minute install. Once again, it's just a small, very light agent. Think of it as a tray app that installs. And now you have recording, customer service, and training recording for Skype for Business. Very affordable, just a fraction of the cost of existing recording solutions, and really easy to implement. And once again, it pulls together OneDrive. Your recordings can be sent up to OneDrive, and you can listen to them from there. So very easy to install, 1 minute, and you just do some very simple configuration, and you're ready to go. You just make calls. And there we have a screenshot of it. You see the little tray app down the lower right. Make your call, and if you have it set to record all calls, it just starts recording and you don't have to think about it. So Call Recording Pro. It's really what we are thinking to fill is training and customer service scenarios. We're not thinking compliance at this moment, and it works with all Skype for Business USB devices. Does not support IP phones, just to make sure we're saying where it does not fit. And if you want updates about that, follow our Twitter account, Attendant Pro. And also, you can see the link there, bit.ly/call recording pro-beta, if you want to sign up for the beta. But we're planning to have something out to market in about a month. All right, so Cepha Util Server, that's what people, I think, we're here to take a look at. And we want to give you an update on what we are doing and one we plan to release. We didn't give a release date before, but we'd like to give that to you. So SAFA Util Server is what we are calling SAFA Util done right, plus some new capabilities. So it's all of what's in SAFA Util from Microsoft, but it brings PowerShell, and it also brings some other capabilities. And we want to talk about that. So PowerShell, it also, another result of making SAFA Util a server, as opposed to just an EXE that runs and then exits, is that the performance is much, it's greatly increased. We're also adding new capabilities, the ability to change presence, change a user note, and we're thinking there's several scenarios that SAFA Util Server will be used. It will be used in the admin kind of scenario where you want to do a mass change, and then also colleague change where you just want to change kind of a boss admin scenario you could think of where you want to change someone else left the office and they want you to change their note or change their presence or change their call forwarding. And after talking to the MVP, the Skype for Business MVPs, we've decided to make a community edition, and I'll explain what is going to be free in that. We're going to give a lot of value for free, so I want to go over that as well. So, SAFA Util. SAFA Util as PowerShell is the top requested feature on link.ideascale.com. The only bigger feature is the improvements on response groups. So a huge demand. We didn't see it coming, and we thought, you know what, we can do this. So there's some obvious benefits of having a SAFA Util server, and that is, you if you have PowerShell, now you can write scripts. You can do mass changes with PowerShell using pipes and scripts. And SAFA Util Server with PowerShell, you can extend it and make user interfaces, graphical user interfaces. Johan Veldius, Anthony Carrigal, they've already done that. It'd be very simple to do it with this, with SAFA Util Server, since you can just automate it using PowerShell. And we've noticed in our tests on very, 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 very modest lab hardware, SAFAUtil.exe, in other words, SAFA Util that comes from Microsoft, in our test, it was something like 14 seconds per contact. So let's say you want to run through 100 contacts and change the forwarding settings. Our tests, 14 seconds per contact. So 14 seconds times 100. And largely this is due to the fact that SAFAUtil.exe from Microsoft needs to fire up the whole environment, do the change, and then it exits the environment, then it loads it up and exits again. SAFA Util Server, it's a Windows service running as a trusted application server. And in our tests, not trying to make anything fabulous here, but in our test, we've noticed something like 100 milliseconds per contact. So it's already running. It doesn't need to fire up the environment and then shut it down again. It just spins through it. And 100 milliseconds, you know, it might not always be that, but something like that for calculation purposes. So huge performance gains with SAFA Util Server. So we've noticed there's kind of different scenarios. We have the administrator mass changes. And that scenario is an administrator wants to change a bunch of contacts. They have ongoing settings. Let's say they want to set the forwarding back to some default setting, and they want to spin through all the contacts in their environment. Well, that's PowerShell, SAFA Util PowerShell enabled is really going to, it makes that much faster. You don't have, you know, if you have a lot of, if you have just a ton of contacts, it can take a long time. And if you're using SAFA Util Server with the increased performance, that just speeds that up greatly. And of course, you're using PowerShell to do it. Then we have the colleague change scenario. And that is where you just want to change another user, let's say presence. Just momentarily change your presence or change the note on behalf of some other user. And the interface that we're providing for that is an instant message bot in PowerShell. So you can do it either way. So set, I'm going off of memory, but let's say set CS user presence, or using an IM bot command that we'll show later. Why an IM bot, you might ask? Well, there's a couple of benefits of this. One is you can do this change outside the edge. and there's no, you know, no additional holes you have to open up or no paths you have to make through to your server. You can just use the existing Skype for Business infrastructure. And there's no additional web service or proxy service. There's nothing you have to, if you use the IMBot, you can do it outside the network and it just works. So new capabilities. So one is with Cepha Util EXE, we want to replicate what Microsoft is already doing. Things like change forwarding, delegates, team call, groups. We want to make parity with that. And then another thing that we have already implemented is additional user settings like change a user's note or change their presence. That's other functionalities. But then other future possibilities that we could add into Cepha Util server that are on to investigate doing is things like contact management. So let's say you set up Skype for Business and you just want all the users to have a preset list of users or groups. And that's something we're looking at. We don't have it implemented, but those are the kind of new capabilities. So Cepha Util functionality, that's in there. And then other things like change note, change presence, and then in the future, maybe things like contact group management. So a demo. We will do a demo. And since we are doing a broadcast, I'm gonna kind of be simulating this. And that is so that you can see it. We have a nice size. If you use PowerShell, it's a little hard to see both that and the screen. So here we go. So let's say we want to do call forwarding via PowerShell. So let's say you do something like, this is enabled already, set-CS user forwarding. And then you pass in the username, what forwarding settings you want to do, and hit enter. 100 milliseconds later, the user that you did, the call forwarding is done. It lets you know it did that and the forwarding is done. So really straightforward, just a PowerShell command. Don't get too attached to the PowerShell command we have there because we know we're kind of overlapping with Microsoft. We might try to make something that's outside the CS user space, but you get the idea. That's what we have implemented now. We might change that before final release. So there you saw, just very simple using PowerShell to change any user's call forwarding settings or a whole group of them, which we'll show later. So another one, now this is going beyond Cepha Util, and this is changing a user's presence. Set CS user presence, pass in the user and what presence you want to change it to, and hit enter, and boom. You notice that user down there, Clayton J. Martin, his presence was set to do not disturb. I think it was available before. So once again, using PowerShell to make a user change. And then let's say we want to change their note. Or maybe we want to go through, check what the note is, and then change if it's something inappropriate. Use your imagination. You can use PowerShell to do it. So, and this is just, we're not doing any piping. We're just doing a simple command here, set CS user note, and pass in the user and the note. And boom, we changed his note to changed by PowerShell. All right. And so now, of course, if you're using PowerShell, you can pipe in and do group changes. So what we're going to do on this one here is, you know, get CS user Martin. We're going to get all the Martins. I mean, I know you wouldn't want to do this in any big organization, but just for example, it makes it simple. Get all the Martins and then change their presence to something preset. So we're going to hit enter on that. And it starts doing it. And there we go. Boop. Jump back there. All right. So now we changed all the Martins to what do we have there? Changed by PowerShell. And I don't have an arrow pointing at it, but you can take a look at the client and you will see that. All right. Now, another thing we talked about is making changes via Instant Message Bot. And we are seeing this scenario, not a scenario where you're changing a whole bunch of settings at one time, but you're only changing one. So maybe you're changing the presence for a colleague, you're changing a note for a colleague, or maybe changing the forwarding settings. And once again, this can be automated by a user interface if you want to use .NET and do that. But so we go into the IM window, we send the command forward slash change presence available, and then pass in the username. in the IM bot in the IM, and we send that to the CephaUtil contact, the CephaUtil server contact, and boom, it passes an IM back saying how long it took to do it. What is it? You see the seconds there. You can take a look at that. And we'll notice the user down in our contact list, that's not me, it's another user, is changed to available. All right. So CephaUtil server, some more details. How do you install it? The installation of CephaUtil server is really an installation comparable to other UCMA apps, UCMA trusted applications. It's a server, so it's a Windows service, needs to be running, like the Skype for Business services. It's a service that will be running, and that gives you your additional performance and makes it so that it's available when you want it. And security. If you're using it in the scenario of CephaUtil commands, the administrator can do anything. But if you have the commercial edition where you're doing other users' presence, there's a security engine where you can granularly determine who can do what. And I won't go into the details of that, but there is security. So CephaUtil server community edition. We haven't previously noted what we are giving away and what is commercial, but here we go. CephaUtil EXE parity functionality. In other words, PowerShell enabled CephaUtil we are planning to release for free. And that is self-supported. You can use our Yammer forum to do that. So you get CephaUtil PowerShell enabled and high performance for free. And it's supported on the forum. If you want support, then that's a commercial edition we have. And also the commercial edition also has additional functionality that we talked about, change presence, change notes, possibly in the future adding contacts, and also the IM bot functionality. That comes with the commercial. Our target release date is March 1, 2016. It's going to be released on the TechNet Gallery. You can see the link there. You can get that. Community versus enterprise as a chart here. So we're giving CephaUtil commands. Those are free. So forwarding, delegate, team manage, SimmelRing, and support, community support. In other words, support each other on the forum. If you want commercial edition, that's where it flips over into the enterprise or the paid edition. So we have, and also running CephaUtil commands using the IM bot, that's on the commercial edition. The user presence commands like change presence, change note, that's with the commercial edition, and granular user security. So there you are. So if you want to get CephaUtil server, watch my Twitter account, which is Matthew Landis, at Matthew Landis. You can always watch what we are up to on my blog at windowspbx.blogspot.com. And the release date is March 1, 2016. And if I'm thinking right, that is my last slide. And I think I've completed on time. So I will be probably not hanging around on this, on the podcast here, but I will be watching Twitter and will try to keep my eye on Yammer if there's any other questions. So thank you, Mark, for the opportunity to be on here.
So session three is about the mobile app, for the Skype for Business mobile app in particular. And this topic was submitted to me by Sean Harry, a well-known community member of the Microsoft UC space. Thanks, Sean. So before we start looking into the mobile app functionality a little bit deeper, let's just look at the high level functions. So we use a mobile app basically just for instant messaging, presence, IP audio and video sessions, and conference joining through your Skype meetings. So recently in the updated version of Skype for Business mobile app, we can now do one-click conference join. And we can also do view people's content such as PowerPoints, desktop sharings on the app, on the move, anywhere that you're at the time. So you can also retrieve your voicemails from Exchange using the enterprise voice functionality. But as with any mobile app, there are some crutches, there are some problems using it. And the most problems are caused by relying on your third-party network, so your Vodafones, your O2s, and your EEs, the network data network isn't full coverage in the UK at least, So it's questionable whether you'll actually get those high content modalities up and running. So unless you're on public Wi-Fi, for instance. Because they're unmetered, they're metered networks and they're unmanaged from an admin perspective, we can't do anything like quality of service on those, or we can't guarantee a consistent delivery. So just bear that in mind when pushing out mobile apps to users. Tell them to use it for instant messaging and obviously when they're outside the office, but don't. If they've got access to a workstation, then please use that client in favour of the mobile app. So, well, we'll come on to push notifications in a little while, but basically if the Skype Business app is minimised in the background and the push notification fails because you've got no data signal, then the instant message, 9 times out of 10, fails delivery to that user. So it shouldn't be relied on as a guaranteed messaging communication tool. We also have limited administrative control of the mobile app, and that basically means that we can't really control how we deploy that app or how that app gets deployed to mobile devices, because everybody's got personal devices. They can go to the app stores with Google Play, Android, Windows Store, etc., and download the app, sign in, and there's not much that we can do about that. So just bear that in mind. Some of the use cases for the mobile app, as I've alluded to in the previous slides, is that first and foremost, it's a quite reliable instant messaging tool. So if you're on the move and you want to send a message to someone or you want to reach somebody, it will work reasonably well as an instant messaging tool. One-click conference join, as I alluded to before, we can view our Skype meetings, upcoming Skype meetings in the app, and we can click and join the Skype conference through the app. The other big plus for the mobile app is that you can be anywhere, anytime, and update your call forwarding settings. So maybe you've got enterprise voice deployed on your account, and you're currently forwarded to an extension in the office, but now you're out of the office, you want to update that forwarding setting to maybe point to your home phone or to another office phone somewhere. So while it's on the move, you can update your call forwarding settings really quickly and really simply. That's a big advantage over normal UC products. So some supported devices: iOS, Apple, Android, and Windows Mobile. They're your main three supported devices. So Android's got very wide range support on the devices, but there are some still old devices using the Tegra 2 chipset that aren't supported for the Skype app. BlackBerry, I mean, to be fair, who uses them anymore? But that's not supported. There's no Skype app for the BlackBerry devices running BlackBerry iOS, but I believe in the last few days there's been support on the BlackBerry Priv, which is an Android version. So if you've got a BlackBerry Priv, you can now download the Skype for Business app on there and consume the service. So there are some dependencies for the mobile app to be active and to be running. And like any other Skype for Business functionality, you need a front end server. And because the mobile app runs over web services, we also need a reverse proxy server. And those two requirements are essentially it's in terms of hardware's perspective, if you want to just do instant messaging presence. But if you want to do IP audio and video, then you're going to need an edge server for that media and push notifications too. As Corey mentioned in his session, public SSL certificates are required on both a reverse proxy and edge server. And obviously the user needs to be enabled for mobility services within Link. So that's just a user policy, whether that's assigned as global site or user. And obviously you need the public DNS records for automatic client discovery. So on the front end server, the way that the client works is that it's always treated as an external source, even from when it's inside the network. And to that extent, when it does, when it looks up the web services URL, it's going to look up the external web directory on the front end server. And for that to happen, it needs to go via the reverse proxy. So the mobile app also is built, or the Skype for Business app is built on UCUI, or the Unified Communications Web App, web application, API, sorry. But older clients, such as the 2010 client, were built and they depend on the MCX service. And virtual directories in the external interface for collecting, registering and consuming services. Authentication is happens much in the likes of the same as the desktop client, in terms that it will do NTLM authentication first, and then if you save your password, it will then request an Accept 509 certificate and use that moving forward. Users can be assigned a mobile policy, which you can enforce audio over Wi-Fi, video over Wi-Fi, but it gives you very limited control over, you know, whether the app can be running in the background consistently without the users forcing the closure of that service. That's one of the questions that customers ask me, is if they can control that so that the Skype app is always on them on the user's device. To my knowledge, that not even Windows Intune can force that functionality just yet. And traditionally, when we were updating Link Server, if you had a look at the process for that update, one of the last steps is to rerun the Bootstrapper command to re-enable UCWare on all the front ends. So with the Skype for Business CE1 release, that command's no longer, or that process no longer needed. So we don't need to run Bootstrapper after we update Skype for Business servers anymore. For the reverse proxy, what that essentially does is take a request coming in over HTTPS on the standard port 443, and then sends that request to the front end servers on a non-standard port called 443, and that way it hits the external web services. And then the front end server replies back through that same path so that the mobile client can receive connections over a standard port. And that basically means that for an end user experience, it's all seamless and all automatic. There's no fancy port additions onto the end of URLs, for instance. When you're deploying mobility or any Skype edge service, it's important not to employ asymmetric routing. So that asymmetric routing is where the backend servers have a different route to the internet than the outside request is coming in. So it's important that when requests come in by the reverse proxy, the reverse proxy is going to answer back on the public IP that it came in from. And the way, there are a couple of requirements on the reverse proxy in terms of hardware. That, like Corey said, there's only two certified at the moment for Skype for Business, but we all know Kemp's work and we all know TMG works, etc. It's just not supported by or certified for Microsoft at the moment. So essentially any reverse proxy can be used. That was within Link 2013. There's only a couple of requirements really in terms of any type of content caching needs to be disabled on the web proxies. I know if you're using the pirate proxy ISR, you have to disable caching and content caching on there. And the reverse proxy should support cookie-based persistence rather than source address-based persistence. And that essentially, so when you're on your mobile phone, you traverse different access points. As you're on the move, your source address will change. And that's by doing cookie-based persistence means you don't have to re-authenticate every single time you hop access point. So for the edge server, like I said before, you don't actually need it if you only want to do instant messaging and presence. But you do need it if you want to run any AV or audio or video, or if you want to enable push notifications to mobile devices. And the mobile app relies much the same as the desktop client and relies on stun and turn. And if you want to know more about those workloads, Anthony Carroll did a session on Edge Media in episode one. So you can see the link there to episode one if you want to review. So in the public world, it relies on a couple of DNS records for automatic discovery. The first one is link discover, that's .zipdomain.com or whatever your zip domain address is. And that's used for gathering your web, your external FQDN, service FQDNs, as well as identifying your user's home pool. The web services, this generally in the link world used to be on the Technic documentation is linkwebx.domain.com, but essentially this can be anything that you've done, and Corey's mentioned where you can find that. I personally use SWS for web services now in Skype, so Skype Web Services, and that's used for all your communication and your signaling traffic to your mobile app. The meet and dial-in domains, they're not necessarily required for signing purposes, but they're going to be required if you want to do conference join, or if you want to change your PIN on the move. AV on the Edge server, that will, the AV domain name on the Edge server, that will be used for any type of media traversal between the outside world and the inside world. For the REST proxy, you need obviously at least one. If you want high availability, you can have two clustered. What I tend to do is do clustered KEMP load balancers. And if you deploy an Edge server, what we recommend that you do is deploy the Edge server with the three independent public IPs rather than the one co-located one. It just gives additional flexibility moving forward. And those public IPs must not be used by any other service that you currently host. It must be a one-to-one NAT. So no sort port-based NAT or source-based NAT. So I'm not going to touch too much on SSL certificates because Corey spent a good portion of his time discussing this in detail. But the public certificate for the discovery and for the web service must be installed on the reverse proxy. Wildcard is supported, but again, use UCC SAN certificates. So the common name for the reverse proxy usually is the web services URL, and the subject alternative names are usually the link discover and the simple URL such as meet and dial in. And again, the hashing, the algorithm supported is a 256-bit SHA-2, although it will support, I think it will support 512 now, won't it? If you want to as well. So the discovery service, if we look at how users authenticate to and use the mobile app, generally what happens is that when you first sign into the mobile app, it will do a discovery of the link discover URL. And this will then return an XML-based response, which will contain your external FQDNs, and once you've authenticated, it will then, find the user's home port. So the discovery is kind of a two-phased approach. So the first discovery is an unauth discovery. So you can expose those external FQDNs to the client, and then the client will then authenticate, and then the additional discovery process is done to find the user's home port. So looking at this in a little bit more detail, so a packet capture from my mobile device the other day, we can see that when I attempt to sign in, that the mobile app goes off and tries to discover linkdiscover.theskypeshow.com. And because we're using Office 365, we get a redirect to the EMEA version of the Skype services. And here we can see the auto discover response come back from the servers, and the first note there is really to look at the access location. You can see that that's defined as external. So what that means is that the app is going to use all the external FQDNs that it finds in that XML response, and then attempt connection to do its authentication and registration using those URLs. As you can see in the next highlighted section, exposing the MCX and the UCWA URLs. If you want to know a deeper dive into Link Discover and how it works, I recommend you head on over to Graham Cropley's blog, the linkexch.co.uk. He's got a very good article on Link Discover and the certificate provisioning service. So it's a good read. Recommend that you go and watch that. So when it comes to authentication, as we've talked about, the first authentication method is NTLM, and what that does, it takes your username and your hash of your password and sends that off to the web ticket service via the reverse proxy. That web ticket service then will process that authentication and make sure that you're a valid user and provide that mobile app with a SAML assertion, which then will form your web ticket. And that web ticket then is assigned to every single SIP request that you send after that, or every single SOAP request that you send via the mobile app back to the front end pool. If you click Save Password, then the X509 certificate is supplied to the device, and that is used as as the default authentication mechanism moving forward. Again, as Corey said, it's got a default maximum of 180 days before NTLM occurs again. You can take additional steps to limit or reduce those days if you want. So maybe reduce it to 30 days, for instance. For additional security, maybe you want to consider multi-factor authentication, but that really is for on-premise deployments only. Currently, I'm not aware of a multi-factor authentication process for Office 365 Skype for Business Online. I've had fun in the past with trying to do that using ADFS and internal PKI, but it turns down to the fact that Skype for Business Online doesn't like passive authentication, and for MFA you need passive authentication to be enabled. So single factor authentication, this is just I discussed this briefly in the last slide, in terms of that the NTLM often request is sent to the web ticket service, and the packet capture to the right is an extract of the SAML assertion coming back. And then after you've proved your identity and you've got your X509 certificate in replacement of your password, then the Skype for Business app will then, the signing process will be much faster, much more seamless to the user. And one of the downsides of NTLM, besides the fact that it's passing your username and password and hash of your password and relying on an SSL encryption to hide that information, is that it has a dependency on your Active Directory to be available at the time of authentication. So if your AD is down or there's some problems with it, then obviously users with NTLM won't be able to authenticate, but if you've got an X509 certificate already assigned to you, you're going to be using that authentication mechanism and you're not going to be affected while your AD is down. And whilst all this is quite secure, it's not so secure if you leave your phone unlocked. So if you're going about and out and about, make sure you've got a PIN code. Make sure that, like your laptops, when you leave them on the desk, that they're locked, etc. So for multi-factor authentication, as I alluded to before, it's not aware that it's supported on Skype for Business Online just yet. I know we can use Azure app passwords as a authentication mechanism, but that basically is an app to bypass Azure MFA. So it's not really a multi-factor solution, it's just a workaround to the problem. Last time I spoke to Microsoft, they were working on trying to introduce some kind of MFA with Azure for Skype for Business Online. Maybe when Server 2016 comes out, maybe there will be some kind of introduction to ADAL, etc. For Skype for Business Online. So for multi-factor authentication, basically requires passive auth, like I come to it before. For an on-premise deployment, you can configure passive authentication, but the biggest, it's not something that you just go out and do without any real thought, because in order to enable passive authentication, you must disable all of the forms. So that's NTLM and certificate. So unless you know what you're doing with ADFS and you've got that planned, don't go and just fire it in and think that, you know, I'm now going to use passive authentication, everything's going to be fine. The mobile app can integrate with Exchange, and it integrates Exchange in a number of ways for a number of reasons. One of the reasons to get your calendar free busy information, your upcoming meetings, so that could be Skype meetings and with your conference join links, and also it will look up for conversation history and voicemail. So if you have a voicemail that's been left on Exchange, you can actually play that within your Skype for Business app. One of the really cool features of the Android app, I'm not sure about Windows or iOS, is that you can replay your voicemails in two speed, so in double speed, which is quite funny sometimes. If you want a bit of a laugh while you're on the move, recommend that you do it. But in order for Exchange integration to work, what needs to happen is that you need to publish your Exchange Autodiscover and your Exchange Web Service URLs or EWS URL to the internet, as well as the internal network. Now, the link, the Skype client and the mobile client are hard-coded to look for autodiscover.domain.com for Exchange discovery. At present, there's no way of changing that, I don't believe. So there are a lot of businesses that have reworked their AutoDiscover service, and you must supply that DNS record, as whether it's a redirection or whether it's a straight pass through to your Exchange AutoDiscover service. The AutoDiscover service happens after client sign in, so it doesn't happen when you first sign into the mobile app. Once you sign into the mobile app, you've registered with your front end server. Exchange Discovery is done at that point. Because it's a separate service, and because it's not, we can't use the certificate that's been assigned to the Skype mobile app for authentication with Exchange, and we can't pass NTLM authentication tickets from Skype app to Exchange. We have to perform a brand new NTLM authentication request to Exchange to get that information. And this is just a bit of a capture of the AutoDiscover happening on my account here, and we can see that after clients sign in, we're going off to find autodiscoveres.outlook.com, and then we're getting back a response which contains my front end and back end server and computed back end server QDN, which then is used to extract your calendar free busy information, voicemails, etc. So mobile app inside your network. As I've alluded to in the past, your mobile app is always treated as an external source, no matter where you're at. So if you're on internal Wi-Fi in your corporate network, or if you're on 3G, it's got to be external. There, you can't send the web requests to the internal web surface URLs. So in order to do that, what we need to do when the mobile app is on internal Wi-Fi is to hairpin the web services URL and the web service URL via your external interface of your reverse proxy. So that can be done in a number of ways, either that you create a DNS record for sws.domain.com and point it to the private IP of the reverse proxy in the external DMZ interface, or you send it to the public IP and ask your security firewall guide to enable firewall hairpinning, but on the entrusted side of the firewall device, but you'll find a lot of resistance from firewall admins to do that. So generally what we tend to do is just take them out of the equation and hairpin it on the reverse proxy itself. The discovery of the Skype services when you're inside the network, we'll use the link discover internal record as a first contact, and because you've got a local DNS zone for your SIP domain, and you'll have that link discover internal record for internal client discovery on your desktops, that will be available. And because we do HTTP discovery before HTTPS, we don't need to look at the certificate in terms of the mobile app to get the external interfaces, your FQDNs, no authentication is required. All the signaling for the app and all the web requests will go via the reverse proxy. But if you're doing a peer-to-peer audio call between a client, a desktop client and a mobile client, or two mobile clients within your Wi-Fi network, then hopefully media will be established directly from point to point. And this is shown in this little diagram here. As we can see, the AutoDiscover comes locally and the signaling externally through reverse proxy, and direct media establishment happens. Now, there are cases where might be internal hardware firewalls between networks on your internal side. So perhaps you've got two remote sites, but there's a link between them, but there's a firewall governing that, and your policy states that you can't enable ports, so there's no direct media path available. So in this example, what happens is that the media is traversed using the edge service. So the media from the mobile app will go out and be hairpinned back in using the edge server onto the desktop client, and media be established that way. And again, with internal mobile to external, so that's going to work in much the same way as a traditional Skype workstation client, in that media will go via the edge server for establishment. And obviously, I'm not going to repeat myself too much about the signaling and discovery service. Mobile outside your network, so typically the external DNS records will need to be enabled, need to be available for your edge services and your discovery and web URLs and simple URLs. And if you're establishing media when you're outside the network, then it's going to use your edge servers as a media relay for that service. And this diagram just shows that really. When you're configuring mobility, the mobility policies are based on site, user, or global level. Now, typically, you apply a user policy to each user, so it gives you a bit more granular control over your user base. And you can force in that policy, you can enforce Wi-Fi for content sharing, audio and video, and that gives you a bit of control over how much bandwidth you're consuming on your mobile data plans, for instance. Outside voice, or call via work, as it was called in Link 2013, you can enable that too if you have that functionality named and enabled. And if you want to have a view of your policies, you can use the get CS mobility policy command, and followed by the policy name that you want to have a look at the settings. And obviously, you can use the set or the new and the grant commands respectively to apply and create those. So there's a little bit of advanced configuration that you can do with the mobility, and that you can configure the MTX service using PowerShell. And essentially, if you're not going to do mobile app externally and you want to disable that functionality, then you can use a set CSMTX configuration command to basically not expose your external web URL. So there's a number of testing facilities you can use to test whether mobile functionality is going to work before you attempt it in real life. We're all very much familiar with the testconnectivity.microsoft.com URL. Some of you may be less familiar about the Link 2013 connectivity analyzer tool, which will test mobile settings internally and externally. Go ahead and you can download that directly from Microsoft using that that link that provided in the slide. And obviously we've got a couple of PowerShell commands. We've got test CS MCX UC web conference and test CS MCX P2P IM. So the latter command is used for testing Link 2010 apps, and the UC ones are using for testing Link 2013 and Skype for Business clients. In terms of push notifications, these are fire and forget requests that go off from the edge server when the mobile app is minimized. So what happens is that the message is sent to the mobile app. If it's not on in the background, the request is sent to the Microsoft push notification service or the Apple push notification service, and that then is entrusted to deliver that notification to the user. And that's when the mobile app is minimized on the user's phone. Obviously, it's fire and forget in terms of how Skype see it, but there may be some tolerance built into Apple and Microsoft for a number of retries before the notification is discarded. Obviously, it shouldn't be relied on as a method of contact, a reliable method of contact. So if you do get a failed IM message that hasn't been delivered, then please use another form of communication to try and contact that person. Push notifications aren't enabled by default. You can enable them either in the control panel or using PowerShell. But in order to use the Microsoft push notification service, you need to federate with Office 365. You don't actually need to have an Office 365 tenant. You just need to be able to federate to that service in order to use MPNS. The Apple push notification service has an additional dependency if Apple devices are joined to your internal Wi-Fi, in that you must allow port 5223 into in and out to that network. So there are a few things that you can do, and the way the push notifications work is that the mobile app is responsible for sending a notification to the push notification service within a set period of time. That default period of time is set at 3 days. If the mobile app doesn't send that notification to that push notification service, then the session expires and the push notifications not received. So you can increase the session expiration time using those PowerShell commands for Apple and Windows and for Android device, Nokia devices. And you can extend that up to 49,710 days. But if you really want to be nerdy, it's 4,294,967,295 seconds. So pretty much infinity, to be fair. Just a bit of trivia there. Obviously, we can test push notification service. So when we test in Microsoft push notifications, first of all, it's recommended that you test Federation to Office 365. So you can do that using Test CS Federated Partner and the appropriate parameters, and then followed by the Test CS MCX push notification and specifying your internal Edge FQDN for as the Edge service, and then that will test whether push notifications will work. For Android, there's no push notification service. So Microsoft have recently released an update to the app. I think it was end of last week. And that basically allows the mobile app to be always running in the background. So again, what happens in this instance, as you can see with the screenshots I've got there, is that when the IM is sent to that mobile app, you get a screen pop at the top of your phone, and you'll be able to click on tap on it and then continue with that conversation. I have used it in a little bit, and it seems a lot more smoother than having the app minimized, shut down in the background, and having to spin it up into memory, etc., and crashing and having to re-sign in and all that frustration. Downside is that it consumes battery life, and if you're going to rely on that setting to be always on, then carry a spare battery with you or have a charging kit handy. In terms of mobile app deployment, generally we leave that to the consumer to download from the appropriate app store, but if you want to use an MDM solution to push that mobile app out to devices, then what we recommend you do is you use Microsoft System Center Configuration Manager in together with Intune to package and push that mobile app out to your corporate devices. And I'm not going to pretend I know how to do that. So if you go head off to MVP Jerry Hampson's guide, there at the link there is a detailed how-to guide on how to set that up within SCCM and Intune. And that concludes the session. And thank you very much for listening and taking the time out of your evening, morning and afternoon. Just a few closing slides before we hang around for any questions and answers. The next show will be March 7th at 7 o'clock GMT. It's a common time. It's Monday, and a bit of a change to the format of this show in that we have two guests appearing. The first one is Michael Lamontagne, and he'll be talking about the desktop client. And we have Rui Maximo coming on as well to talk about Skype security using his Skype security software. So that should be quite an interesting show to watch. So again, the closing slide for all the other community events that are happening around the world. So UC Architects, they were recording their latest episode last weekend, I believe. So looking forward to sitting listening to that. Obviously, we've got the UC Day coming up later on in the year for UK. And big shout out to Josh Blaylock again for his Skype for Business recap shows that he's committed to every week. So they're quite
thank
cool.
you, Josh.
So yeah, they're quite cool, and looking forward to seeing those cowboy boots. And obviously, we have all the TechNet forums, we have all the next hot blog articles and all the other MVP blogs that are out there providing useful information. If you know of another community event or another important link to show on this slide, then please get in touch with me, let me know what the link is, and I'm quite happy to use this slide to promote community events. So with that in mind, now we move on to session four, which is going to be questions and answers. And as usual, we will do it via Yammer or via Twitter or via email. So if you head on over to Yammer and ask your questions in the episode two group, or ask them out via Twitter using hashtag Skype4BShow, we'll answer them shortly. Thank you very much. Yeah.
we're about to close off the Q&A session. So again, to everybody that's joined our episode two today, really appreciate you taking the time out. If you do have any questions that might come to mind, maybe during a replay of the sessions, then either just send us a message or tweet us on Twitter, or get into the Yammer Network episode two. The group will be available to access. So yeah, we'll see any requests in. Thanks again for joining, and we look forward to seeing you next month on episode three.